Well, I wanted to start with just a general question, and ask you how you got involved with the world of audio and podcasting.
Well, I had a personal connection to it years ago. I used to be a motion picture sound editor in a previous lifetime, but I was writing a book, and in the process of writing the book, I interviewed a number of experts in the field, and I recorded the interview just like you might do to take notes. But in the process, I realized that by talking to these marvelous people, they would always know more about the topic than I ever would. And I said to myself, wouldn't it be great if my readers could, in fact, just hear directly from these people what they had to say? So I called a few of them back and asked them if I could redo the interviews, explicitly with the idea of putting those recordings online. That was in May of 2003. Those interviews were very popular. And people wanted more, so I did more. And a year plus later, podcasting hit, and we sort of just slid into the podcasting world by accident.
So that really seems consistent with the model that IT Conversations has ended up taking on.
You mean doing everything by accident?
No, the expert talks from folks who specialize in a particular subject.
Yeah, we did in the early days, we did interviews only, and we did interviews for about a year. And then in February of 2004, we got involved with our first conference. We actually did a live web broadcast of a conference by O'Reilly Media called Emerging Technology or ETEC. And we streamed that out to a few hundred people, and that was moderately successful. But what happened after the fact was that we reached tens of thousands of people with the on-demand audio after the event. And that was a bit of a wake-up call to realize that we had the potential of working with events that are attended by a few hundred people and actually reaching two orders of magnitude more people. That really changed for us, but it really changed for our event partners. The whole dynamics, because it means that when someone produces a real-world event, we can substantially increase the reach and influence of that event by 100 times. It's a little depressing for our event partners because they're sweating bullets over refreshments and lighting and sound and chairs, and they're doing that for what will ultimately be only 1% of the people who experience their event. So, I guess it was about almost a year ago, I decided to change the focus of what we're doing. We've since created our nonprofit ourselves, which has now taken over all of our channels, including IT Conversations. The Conversations Network is this umbrella network, and the intention is to focus entirely on spoken word events. So we're actually getting out of the interview business. We're getting out of the one person or two person kinds of things and going to coverage of events almost exclusively.
Cool. And is the Conversations Network, has that launched yet?
Yeah, the Conversations Network was incorporated in October. The website went live on January 9th, and that's conversationsnetwork.org.
Wonderful. And did I hear you say in a previous interview that you've found that the listenership follows a sort of long tail pattern over time?
Well, over time, certainly what we see is a bump in the first 24 hours because a number of people subscribe to our programs using RSS. So we'll get subscribers, and there are people who visit the homepage on a regular basis and pick up the latest show. Right now, we're publishing 10 to 12 programs every week. That's going to ramp up to 60 programs a week by the end of the year as we add channels. But we do get most of our traffic for a given show. Well, I shouldn't say always, but the typical show, we see a big bump in the first 24 hours because it's new and then it falls off. However, occasionally we're lucky enough that we have a show that is picked up by the blogging community, and that can bring it up quite high. We had a program just the other day that was featured on Boing Boing, which is a very popular blog. Sometimes we're featured on Slashdot, a very popular technical blog. And when that happens, we actually get more traffic from that than we get in the original release of that program. And then we have some programs that are so popular that they have incredible life. I was just talking to someone else a few minutes ago, About one of our most popular programs is, was a presentation by Malcolm Gladwell, who's the author of The Tipping Point. That program is a year and a half old and is almost at the 100,000 listener level. And that program gets many, many downloads every day, even though it's a year and a half old.
Wow. So working with blogging and RSS and all these different technologies, what sorts of cultural changes do you see podcasting playing a role in?
I mean, there are a couple of places. Obviously, it's disruptive to radio. That's sort of obvious because, you know, it is essentially changing what has been a scarcity of channels and bandwidth and so forth and replacing that with an abundance. So the economics, if you will, at the very least, as well as the available programming, is changing a lot in radio. It's affecting television in the same way. Part of it is that, of course, we're competing for time. Unlike text content, which can be skimmed and crammed and squeezed, audio content and visual content tends to be fairly linear. So we compete for drive time just like everybody else. I think, you know, what we're exposed to, however, is ways in which we can change the world. I mean, that's our focus, and I think that's a focus of a lot of people in nonprofits as well. It's like I say, it started for me really in March of last year when I realized how much email I was getting from people saying that I had changed their lives. And I wasn't used to getting that kind of email. I come from the for-profit sector. And, you know, you try and change people's lives in a way that will make things better for them and for you. But you don't usually get much acknowledgement of that. And so I'm getting email from people all over the world saying that this little thing that we're trying to do with our heads down and not paying it too much attention is really having quite an impact. It's people who can't get to these events because of geography, because of economics, because of time. And we have access to content that really can make a difference in the world. I mean, we go out of our way to find the very best spoken word events that we can on any topic. So, you know, we're certainly disrupting the conference business, hopefully in a good way, because we're not eliminating these conferences, we're just extending their lives. But we are part of the globalization process that's inevitable in our world as technology improves. Mm-hmm.
So a recent Pew study said that the internet was helping and not hurting people's social connections. I'm wondering, are you worried about echo chambers and the cult of the individual that people talk about with the proliferation of on-demand portable media players?
I'm not worried about it. I think that certainly there's an echo chamber problem. I mean, there's a tendency for groups to form and people to just sort of reinforce things within that group. But that is mitigated by the fact that content is available more broadly. And so people have access to these groups, and they can break into these bubbles and communities, and they can leave those communities. You know, there's sort of a viral effect of the fact that, you know, sort of if you feel, pardon a really bad metaphor, you know, similar to the avian flu, where you really can't contain these things anymore. It's just too easy for things to get from one place to another. So I see it overall as more of a plus than anything else.
Me too. So what are some of your favorite subjects that you've seen people engage with in the podcasting world? What sorts of topics?
Well, I'll have to be really honest. I don't have time to listen to too many podcasts. We produce so much stuff here, I don't even get a chance to listen to everything we produce.
Yeah.
But I can tell you about some of the new channels that we're going to be launching during 2006, some of which I think will be particularly interesting to your readers and listeners. One of them is a great channel on social innovation, which is, of course, social entrepreneuring. We have two partners in this area. One is the Stanford Graduate School of Business. They have a program there called the Center for Social Innovation, and another associated with Carnegie Mellon University. So we're going to be doing a whole channel on just social innovation. And like our other channels, this will emphasize conferences or let me say spoken word events. You know, every day on this planet, there are so many events that evaporate, that disappear because no one captures them. And our goal is to get out there and capture produce and publish for free as many of them as we can. So anyway, social innovation is a channel that I think is really exciting, and we've already got some prototypes. We've got a program out there we do called Globe Shakers. Globe Shakers is hosted by Tim Zak, produced by Peter Durand, and it is a an interview style program right now. This actually came about because we have, for the last 2 years, produced the podcast version of Pop Tech. Pop Tech being a very important show held in Maine every year. We've also got a series from Center for Social Innovation at Stanford that just began, and those will migrate to a new channel. We're going to be doing a channel on security. We're going to be doing a channel on futurism. We have another channel we hope to develop on parenting. So we're going to be quite diverse.
That's great. And how are you going to get all the content?
The content is in this case, we have two tiers of content, but in everything I've just described, we actually start working with an executive producer in each channel. That executive producer knows those spaces. So, for example, the parenting executive producer will be very well connected in the parenting world. They will be able to identify those events that we want to cover, and we'll approach them and make our case on why they should work with us to put their stuff online.
Wonderful.
It's just we you know we've got the sales pitch down to a pretty good one. We don't charge them anything, nor do we normally feed any money back into the organization, but we will be able to get their content out, as I say, to 100 times as many people typically as they get at their physical events, and that's usually a compelling enough argument. The event producers only have to incur the cost of recording the event. Once they've been able to give us the audio, we take care of everything. We handle all the post-production. We handle all of the publication. We even handle most of the legal issues and accounting issues and so forth, because we have a team of volunteers all who are located all over the world that do this post-production for us. The only challenge, of course, is that we ourselves have to fund it. So we're always working, hopefully, with our event producer partners and others to find sponsors for what we do. But that's not too bad. There's usually somebody, a couple of organizations in every vertical that wants to sponsor these things.
Good. Well, you all produce such high quality content. I'm not surprised to hear that. I know that the ability to fund podcasting is one of the primary questions that seems to be emerging in the medium. I wonder if there are other big questions in that space that you find especially interesting.
There are a lot, and the problem is that podcasting is quite diverse. I mean, you have people like us who create content that has a very long shelf life, for example. We might take 6 months from the time an event is out before we get all of their audio online. Then you have the typical podcast, however, is more of a serial. There's new content every day or every week, and the new content tends to replace the old content. So they have very low archival value and very, very important current value, very high current value. So because of that, that diversity along that axis means that there's quite a bit of variability in the world of podcasting. You have repurposed content from public radio, for example. You have corporate content. And then, of course, there's the whole world of music. If you listen to, my guess is if you were to survey most of the podcasts that are available, I would think that a huge number of them are music-centric at this point. A lot of them copy a typical radio show format. So, there's so much out there, it's hard to pin down even one or two things that apply to podcasting overall.
Does podcasting ever face the same kind of credibility challenges that blogging does because of the dominance of personal blogs in the blogosphere?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, podcasting is more, I would say podcasting is more like blogging than it is like radio, and it has all the advantages and disadvantages that blogging has.
What sorts of things are you able to share with people when they question the credibility of the medium of podcasting?
Well, I don't really answer those questions. For me, our credibility is sort of passed through by the events we cover. We get some interesting complaints. We get upset. Some people get upset when there's political content on either end of the spectrum on our programs. People who say they'll never come back because we've become politicized, which we generally are not. There is content which is controversial all the time, but so we don't really bump up against the credibility issue per se. I think the majority of podcasting out there is for entertainment, and therefore, I don't think there's not much credibility in entertainment. I don't think anybody watches Access Hollywood as an authority for what's going on in the world of entertainment.
The Daily Show, maybe for news,
Right.
but
Well, that's it.
yeah,
Yeah. Well, hey, and isn't the Daily Show probably the best news program on?
for sure, for sure.
What does
So
that say?
I wanted to ask you a structural question as well. I was listening to an interview with Mary Hodder on Pod Leaders the other day, and she was saying that podcasts and video blogs are being delivered right now primarily through blog software, just because that's what search engines are best equipped to find content in. But she believes that that's going to change as the amount of multimedia that's available online grows. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that question.
Yeah, right now, I mean, in fact, this is something I discussed with somebody just yesterday. There are two use cases for how you find, or at least two, but two general use cases for how you find podcasts. One is you're looking for a podcast. You know, say, I want to find a podcast. Maybe I want to find a podcast on a topic, or I want to find a podcast on some other basis, but I am explicitly looking for a podcast. In that case, today, you go to a podcast directory. You go primarily to iTunes, or you go to Odeo, or you go to some other online directory of podcasts. The other is a more serendipitous format, and that is where you're searching for a topic. You're looking for information about that topic. You go to Google, or you go to Yahoo, or MSN, and you do a regular search. And along the way, you discover audio, podcast, or otherwise. You may not have intended to, you may not even want to hear audio, but that's what you found. So you have those two different situations. Today, Conversations Network is very well served by the second model as well as the first model, and that's because our content has always a great deal of textual information with it. Unlike, I mean, most podcasters, it's all about the audio. You put the audio online and that's it. We invest as many person hours in our textual content as we do in our audio. We have editors who write descriptions. They bring in biographies. We have photographs for every program. So that has caused us to be very highly ranked by search engines like Google, and therefore a lot of our traffic comes in that way. What Mary's talking about is that we're going to see an increase of actual rich media search. There are organizations, for example, Yahoo has a very good program underway for rich media search, primarily in video, a little bit less in audio. We work with a company called, what are they called? Podscope. Podscope. Right now, if you go to IT Conversations, for example, you can search on things by audio. And this works reasonably well for certain words, but it's getting better all the time. So you will certainly see rich media search as an important technology. Google, Yahoo in particular, those two are doing quite a bit of work in that area.
Yeah, Podscope is awesome because it will let you start a file at the point at which your search terms appear.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And it provides an RSS feed from their search engine. So you think there is a future then for some of those small audio search engines like Podscope or Podzinger?
Well, the real secret there is that they're all using one or two technology sources. The original work has been done by companies like Bolt Beranek and Newman, IBM. There are a fairly small number of audio search engines out there, real algorithm stuff. So if you drill down on a lot of these companies, you find that underneath it all, they're using a lot of the same technology.
I believe it. So before I let you go, I wonder if you have any suggestions for aspiring documentary podcasters out there, and or any thoughts on steps that might make it easier for a nonprofit organization or someone who only wants to podcast casually at times to be able to do so more easily.
That's a good question. Obviously, you first want to get over the technological issues so that you can focus on your content. And in that case, you might do well to look at something like Odeo that is very, very simple and work your way up in terms of technology. I think there's an awful lot of learn by doing that has to be practiced here. There is a lot to learn. It's not easy at first. And you also develop an ear, and I say that in two ways. You develop an ear for the audio quality as well as an ear for the content and the style. And the only way to solve these problems is to do it. You have to get involved and you have to spend some time experimenting. And you shouldn't be afraid to experiment. Don't lock yourself into a format. I happen to like the occasional podcast model. I think it's one of the best because it almost by definition requires that you experiment. Don't sit down and design a studio and pick your format and make it rigid. You're much better off getting out there doing it and making sure you have a mechanism for feedback from listeners.
That sounds like great advice. Well, I sure appreciate all your time and thoughts, Doug.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Good, good. Okay, well.